This is Teachers Talk Radio, and you are listening live.
Welcome. I want to wish you a warm welcome to the show today. We have Miss James Crofts here with us today, and I'll highlight the importance of efficient exam preparation, school behaviour management, staff CPD, and innovative pedagogy in fostering educational success.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and you are listening live. Tune in live at ttradio.org, or to join in the conversation, download the Podbean app and search Teachers Talk Radio. Follow the hashtag TTRadio. Tune in, talk it out with Teachers Talk Radio.
Okay, good morning. I'm not sure.
This show is brought to you in partnership with John.
I'm just trying to get used to this at the moment. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Can you hear me twice, or is it once?
It's a little bit echoey.
All right, let me see if I could just fix that. First thing though, whilst I'm doing that, can you just introduce yourself and give us a little bit overview of your educational background?
Yes, so my name's Joanne. I am a science teacher. I've been teaching for 6.5 years. So I've been I've done second in science for 2 years, and I've got promoted to a lead practitioner recently. And I oversee the rollout of instructional coaching at my current school using StepLab. So all things teaching and learning, I'm really passionate about. And yeah, I love going to research eds, which I find really funny. I was at the latest research ed in Birmingham, and I've seen how crazy Twitter's gone over that. So I don't know if anyone's seen all of the memes and everything that's came through from that this weekend.
Hello, can you hear me now?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Is it less echoey?
Yeah.
All right, we've got there. Yeah, so I was having a look at Twitter, and it did get quite intense over the last 12 hours, maybe. But we can get onto that in a second, maybe some of the ideas that you might have seen from that. Obviously, this discussion mainly, or at least the first part of it, is going to be effective exam preparation. What motivated you to focus on decoding exam questions as an key area of your teaching?
So really, I think it all stemmed back from being a trainee, and I'll be completely honest, it was almost like a tick box exercise. It was something that I was told, you know, we need to make sure we're doing this for students, and it was almost like going through the motions, and I did it to make sure that, you know, I could really demonstrate it when we're doing lesson observations. And then, you know, it's something that probably for the first 2, maybe 3 years of my teaching, I just assumed students knew. Like, you know, describe and explain, especially secondary education, these students are coming into contact with these words every day. So it was almost very naive of me, a given that, you know, that students would be able to tell us what these mean. And it wasn't until we started doing year 11 assessments and we started marking them, and you realise that regardless of if the question was asking students to describe or explain or evaluate, justify, all our answers were the same. So they weren't really honing in on what that exam question was asking them to do. They were just giving a standard response based on the content of the question rather than what the question itself was asking.
Yeah, I think actually having I'm a science teacher as well, and I do find that sometimes, like, for example, if someone reads that a question's about photosynthesis or something like that, they just start chucking in everything that they possibly know about it without really understanding what the question's about. I've read your blog. It was a really well-written blog, and in there you talk about the bug bug the question technique. What exactly is bug the question technique and how did it come to be?
So for me, bugging the question was something that I did, like I say, in my training year, and brought it over to my new school when I started them. And essentially, it's an exam technique to make sure students really understand what is asking from the question. So the B stands for box, so they box the command words. U stands for underline the key information in the text. And G is for glance back and look over the question. And the introduction of bug has been, you know, revolutionary in my teaching, at least, into making sure that students know what the question is asking, or at least that's what I thought, because it dawned on me really quickly that students knew how to bug a question. And they could tell me what that command word was, and they could underline the key parts of the question, and they could glance back over the question and, you know, have a good understanding of what they need to maybe talk about, but not the actual exam technique. So it went back to the same. They knew the exam question might be asking them to describe or explain, but they didn't know the difference between that. The thing that I really like about bug is that you can use it at any sort of key stage. So we use it at key stage 3, we use it at key stage 4 and key stage 5. And also it's not science specific. So it's something that we've rolled out whole school now. And I'm a big fan of wherever possible rolling stuff out whole school. And I know, you know, some people don't like that idea and some people really like, you know, having the freedom to teach how they want, which I totally understand. But for students who are SEND or students, you know, who really struggle with cognitive overload, having a universal, you know, method to decode exam questions and to understand how to answer exam questions like bug can be really useful.
My kind of question here is, I do agree that when you do something in a whole school approach, it really works really, really well, because that transparency across all of the subjects works well. You know, so obviously the topic's mainly going to go into command words, but if you were to look at the command word for example, evaluate, in maths that has a completely different meaning to what we might expect it to mean in science. How would you tackle that scenario?
Yeah, so I think when we look into command words, that is something that regardless of the subject, they are very different. And again, I know we're both science teachers, and the one that always comes up for me when I think about maths is lines are best fit. And I don't know how many times I've told students that in science, lines are best fit can be a curve, because it's hammered into them in maths. Obviously, it has to be a straight line. So I think what the command words themselves mean has definitely got to be subject specific. But the technique of bug as a whole, you know, we can use across the school. And I think, and I'll be honest, I haven't done enough research into it and looked into it yet, but it'd be really interesting to see how similar they are for all the different subjects like history and geography, you know, sociology, and whether we could almost become up with a universal sheet. And it's almost using if this is the command word, then this is the strategy. I personally don't think that would ever work. But I do think if we could have something like that for the students who really struggle with cognitive overload, it could really benefit them. And let's face it, these students, are they going to be the students necessarily aiming for the grade 8 and the 9? So if they, you know, were aiming for the 4s and the 5s with them, they could potentially get by with a universal sheet that has, you know, the exams commands, sorry, the command questions as a general, as a whole, if that sort of makes sense. I'm not sure how different they are across all the different subjects.
Yeah, I feel like obviously command words would depend on multiple different things as well. I do agree with you. I think it would be very, very tough to have command words taught across a whole school or a whole school strategy, because obviously it depends on multiple things like the subject itself and also the exam board as well, because across different exam boards you have totally different command words that are used. Now, in your blog you spoke about the emphasis that you have applied this year on command words. Can you share the success of this activity?
Yeah, so obviously just with everything that's gone on Twitter, there's no actual scientific research, so I can only share my own experiences. But it's really, really encouraging that I know now straight away, if I say to students, this is an explain question, straight away, I don't even have to ask what explain means. I will have students put their hand up, or even some students get really excited and almost shout out and say, oh, that means we need you to use the words because and so in our answer. And I think in terms of the common ones, explain and describe, and because I have really honed in on this from September. And for those of you that haven't read the blog, I'll just quickly go through how I teach command words. So we teach them by being really explicit in the beginning of the year in September when we first come across them. So if this is a describe question, this is what it means. If it's an explain question, this is what it means. And these are the type of words, or this is almost a sentence starter that you need to include in your answer. And then as time progresses and going through the lessons, we do a 6-question retrieval DNA. And as much as possible, we try to have a command word as one of those activates. So what does describe mean? What does evaluate mean? What does justify mean? And as well as that, once they've got to know what those command word means, it's okay, so what strategy do we put in place if it's describe, if it's justify, if it's explain? And then once we've done that in September, and you know, we've got it September, October, November, I've noticed that by the time we come around to December, January time, we don't need to include those as the activates as much. I still do from time to time, and especially for less common exam questions, such as plan an investigation or evaluate. But then what we also do is we have our lesson outcomes. We've recently moved to booklet, so we don't have to write our lesson outcomes out, which I know some schools do have to, and I know some schools don't. But we have them printed in our booklet. So whenever we have our lesson outcome and we explicitly go through the lesson outcome, I do think it's important to make sure students know what's coming up in that lesson. We bug the lesson outcome, so we're practicing that bug technique all the time. And then when we are boxing that command word, we are saying what that command word means, and we are also then saying what are the strategies to overcome that. So if it's evaluate, we're going to say the pros, we're going to say the cons, and then we're going to justify our answer at the end. We're going to say which one we believe and why. And we're at that point now towards, you know, coming up towards the final term, where that would just be me stood at the front cold calling a student just to make sure that we know. But towards the beginning of the year, it was a mini whiteboard task to make sure that all of the students knew this. And I am fairly confident that my students know these now. And I have put such an emphasis on this. And I haven't waited until they're at GCSE in year 10 and year 11. I've done it all the way from year 7. But I'm still getting them to actively record it. I'm still emphasising that we bug the lesson outcome every time, because I do think it's really important. And I think it's good for us to model that to the students. And I also do it through the guided practice. So we have an I do, we do, you do stage of guided practice. So as soon as the I do comes up, I will model my thought process when I bug the question and I say, right, it's a command question that says this, so I know I have to do this. And then it gets to the we do stage, where I might call on a student to ask. And when it comes to the I do, and they are having to go at the exam questions themselves, when I'm doing my assertive monitoring and I'm going around and I'm circulating, I'm making sure that the students are first bugging the question, but also writing next to the command word what that means. And I think that's a really important thing to get over here. It's not just one day I thought, you know what, I'll start giving them some command words, and then the next week they knew it. This is something that has been building up every lesson from the beginning of the year. And I think what we all know is how time poor we are as teachers, especially when it comes to teaching the GCSE content. So at my school, we start GCSEs in year 10. I know quite a lot of schools do it in year 9, especially for science, to get through the content. If we are then also having to add exam technique into that, it gets even more pushed for time. So that's why I think it's really important to do it from the beginning of the year and beginning of the school year groups, and to start with year 7. So by the time they get to us in year 10 and 11 doing their GCSEs, they're already confident and they know what they're supposed to be doing.
Have you seen, sorry, just to quickly jump in there, have you seen an improvement in the students' like grades and their performance in answering the questions using like by having such a heavy focus on the command?
Yeah, so definitely when it comes to the 6 markers. So traditionally in the past, I've had year 11 groups that don't even attempt the 6 markers, where students are all attempting all the questions now, and they are using the right technique to do them. I find this really useful because they know how to answer the questions now. When we've just had our second lot of, or our last lot of PPEs before they go into the real exams, when we're looking at the QLAs from that now, we know whether it's because the students didn't understand the content or because they struggled with that exam skill. Now, that is something that I really struggled with previously. And it's, if I'm being honest, it's probably one of the key things that prompted me to focus on this as well, being reflective, is I would look at the QLAs and it's always, you know, questions 6, 7, 8 that they haven't answered. And it was always like, well, is it because they don't know that content, or is it because they can't answer that exam question? And students are a lot more confident now in answering those 6 markers, and we can then work out from that what exam content, subject content, sorry, is missing. And I think that's been really, really valuable, because otherwise, you know, you could have the best QLA in the world, but it's never going to tell you whether it's because the student didn't know the content or the student didn't know that skill. And ultimately, that is what we need to know to be able to help our students.
I do think that falls into the fundamental flaw of QLAs, because essentially you'll look at a QLA and you might think, well, students have performed really badly on, I don't know, radioactivity. But in actuality, it's not because they don't understand the concept of radioactivity. It might be that the way those questions were posed were quite tough. So yeah, that's a really good point that no matter how kind of in-depth your QLA is, there might be an underlying issue that you might not be aware of. And I certainly think that, like, I've had a really heavy focus, maybe not so much as you, but I've had a really heavy focus on command words this year in particular, but even last year as well. And I did find, and I have found, sorry, that students that know how to access that particular command word, they definitely answer the question much, much more effectively. Just very quickly, I'm just going to play our ad for 1 second.
This show is brought to you in partnership with John Catt Educational, publishing professional development books and resources to support great teaching and learning in schools around the world. Have you checked out their latest releases? Use the code JCTTR2324 for 20% off your order. Don't miss out. Visit johncattbookshop.com to explore their full range of titles and advance your own professional development today. Happy reading.
I did get the opportunity to read, you had like a Word document, and I read inside that Word document, and I was looking at how you kind of broke up the different command words as well, the tips that you gave students for their different command words, and that was really useful to do. One thing I wanted to say is it's something that I feel like I've noticed. I'm not sure if other people picked up on this. I was just wondering what your opinion was on this. One thing that I found with explain questions in particular, I mean, we know that students have to say why, but I think one thing that teachers might not be pushing their students to is, you know, in an explain question, in science at least, they always have to add some type of TIV-free vocabulary into that answer. So when they're saying why something's happened, if they add in some type of scientific word or definition into that answer, obviously depending on what the question actually is, they're far more likely to kind of hit the points on what that question wants. And I feel like actually, like I didn't notice that in that particular sheet, but I feel like that's something that's really important to note down. But I want to see if you maybe have noticed something similar to that in like when you've been looking at the command word, for example, of explain, if you've kind of noticed the same thing.
Yeah, so I'm really privileged sort of in my teaching journey so far that I've taught predominantly foundation classes, especially in year 11. And I think one of the ways that you approach a foundation class compared to a higher class has got to be actually understanding of how they're going to be assessed and actually looking at the type of command words that they come across. So I did some AQA training recently, just for full disclosure, obviously, I do the AQA course at my school, hence doing the AQA training. But something, although I sort of knew it from looking at the papers, the difference between a high and foundation paper, I didn't know exactly how it was broken down, but 60% of the questions on a lower paper, on a foundation paper, are classed as low demand questions, and 40% are higher demand questions, whereas on the higher paper, it's 40% lower demand questions and 60% higher demand questions. And obviously, with that 40%, you've got the crossover questions, which are the last couple on the foundation are the same as the first couple on the higher. And with that, the lower questions in terms of lower demand are stuff like your describe, your explain, and compare. And it's then your fill in the gaps. It's your draw the lines, complete the sentence. Whereas on the higher, you have got these justifiers and the evaluates and the plans. And I think as a result of that, and I am a lot more sort of biased towards making this more foundation friendly with the explain. But you definitely have a point here with adding that tier three vocabulary. And I think something that my current year 10s are getting really frustrated with, and I totally get where they're coming from as a biology specialist, is the specificness of the words that you have to use. So we're currently going through BFE, which is infection and control. And they get really frustrated that they don't get marks when they say that chlorine gets rid of bacteria. And it's like, no, it doesn't get rid of it, it kills it. If you haven't got that keyword killing, you're not going to get the answer. And when we talk about phagocytosis, phagocytes engulf bacteria. They don't eat the bacteria, they engulf it. And I think actually that is a really key point, and it might be something that I definitely address at when I do a version two. Something that I'm really keen to do and something that I'm spending a lot of my time looking at the minute, obviously I've done these common command words, but it's actually a similar one, but for the maths questions that we do. So there's a lot of graph skills in there in science GCSE. And when we, you know, balancing equations and calculating relative formula mass and, you know, the techniques that come up that we should be doing then. So it was definitely something that I'll look at. And I definitely think there'll be a version two and hopefully like a maths version coming soon.
A maths version would be very, very interesting read. But yeah, no, I personally have noticed that. I think if we take a look at that, that will be really interesting, because I think if students kind of notice this pattern, you know, for example, I tell my students, if a question's about plants and it's an explain question, especially in paper one, there's a very high likelihood that you're going to have to mention something to do with photosynthesis. And that's just because photosynthesis is the key word, and it's the command word for that particular case. And it's those little hints that could really take our students like to the next level. My And you spoke about the engulf and eating, and something that I like to do when I'm modeling. Obviously, I also use the I do, we do, you do model as well. But one thing that I really like to do on the I do, for example, is I might like have two different comparisons. And you kind of cued my memory there, because I actually taught that exact lesson on the human defense system. And I remember, I think there's a 6-mark question on this. I also use AQA as well. And I literally did one example because I used the examiner's report, and the examiner's report stated that students like wrote eats, exactly the same thing that you said, like they write eats instead of engulfs. And I used the examiner's report to kind of make up a bad example. And then I got students discussing a we do, maybe, you know, what did that student, let's say, do wrong, and how could they have pushed that answer to actually get marks? So yeah, certainly those type of, I could see why students get frustrated with that, because it's hard for them to realize that science can be quite specific, and especially in answering those explained questions, you have to be specific. I wanted to kind of ask you, if we look beyond exams, how do you feel command words and or for example, a student's ability to break down exam questions, how do you think that benefits them in their academic journeys, but also their professional futures?
To be honest, I think it's got, like, as much as we want all our students to be GCSE ready, I feel really privileged to teach science, because although, you know, a lot of students, I don't know if it's just my students, but they'll say, "Oh, I don't really like science," or I don't really need science. But science is genuinely, like, it's all around us. You can't escape science. And I think, especially, and I know we're just talking about like the health topic, but when we're teaching students about health and about vaccines and about, you know, being able to analyze data that comes in, you know, and we're teaching them also about life cycle assessments and about, you know, the consequences of global warming and, you know, air pollutants, I do feel like we've got a really important job, not just to get them GCSE ready, but to get them ready for the real world. And I think where, you know, good teaching lies is making sure that our students are motivated to, you know, want to do well. And I think we need to be able to motivate them by giving them the tools to be able to decode these questions. And like I say, describe and explain, it comes up in all walks of life, not just when they're being asked to, you know, answer exam questions. And they are going to have to really evaluate stuff, because, you know, when they get past their GCSEs and past their A-levels and they join the real world, you know, they are going to come across information. They are going to come across news articles or TikToks and, you know, and see things and hear things. And it's, you know, it's important that they can actually hold on. What truth is behind this? Like, how is this going to work? Does this work? And actually be able to come and justify their own answer to things, rather than just, oh, I saw this once, so it must be happening. It must be realistic. I always go, there was always a couple of years ago, a student telling me that they saw on TikTok that they bred, I think it was a snake with an octopus. And I was like, no, that hasn't happened. It was, you know, just like, of course that hasn't happened. It's like, no, there's a video on it. And it's like, that doesn't mean that that's actually happened. Like that, you know, it could be a fake video, you know, you don't know what that's a video of. And it's like, no, of course it is. Like, why would someone lie about that? And I think actually making them inquisitive, making them, you know, question the world around them and, you know, wanting better for the world, I think is really important.
100%. I mean, working scientifically, thinking scientifically, we want our students to become scientists, and in doing so, we want them to question the world around them, and we want them to think, okay, is this really going to work or is it not going to work? And how can I prove, and what can I do to make sure that you know, I'm thinking, and I'm not just watching a random video on TikTok or YouTube and just believing what it says. And so we do have a very vital job. Some aspects of our job kind of comes into PSHE as well, because we do touch some sensitive topics, and it's important that we teach them the right things so they're set up in life in the right possible way. And so, yeah, we do play a very important role. I just wanted to quickly kind of take a step back here, because you mentioned before about the mathematical skills and the graph skills that students need in science. And I think one thing, I mean, there's so many tips that we can give our students. One thing that I've noticed, and it's just simple maths. You know, when the exam question, it gives you a table, and you can clearly see, you know, what the x-axis of that table is and what the y-axis of that table is, because usually the x, if it's a horizontal, sorry, it's a vertical table, the x-axis tends to be on the left and the y-axis tends to be on the right. And if it's a vertical, if it's a horizontal table, the x-axis tends to be on the top and the y-axis tends to be on the bottom. But then the same question will ask students to plot and label their graph, and they don't realize that all they have to do is literally copy the labels from the table and copy it into their graph. And I think there's so many little tips that we could give our students. And I think if you do end up coming up with like a unified kind of approach for mathematic questions, graph questions, I think that would be very, very beneficial for our students. I wanted to ask though, what do you feel having taught the mathematical side of science or the math skills in science, what do you feel students tend to struggle on the most?
So we introduced a new strategy this year, new to us, definitely not new to everyone else, but the FIFA method. I'm not sure if you've heard of the FIFA method before.
Is that similar to the discus method, where it's a similar approach? Students write down, like, I don't know, in the discus method, they write down their data points, write down the equations, substitute values, calculate, and then significant figures. Is it similar to that?
Yeah, exactly. Just think whoever invented FIFA was trying to be one of the cool dads and down with the kids because it's FIFA and it's football. I don't know. Maybe. But essentially it stands for formula. So you write the formula out, I insert the numbers. F stands for fine tune. So that is if you have to rearrange anything or you have to do any conversions. And then A, you give your answer. And it's something that we've introduced this year. And we started with our physicist introducing it. So we traditionally always taught all subjects, all science disciplines, not because we're quite fortunate actually to have an equal weighting of chemists, physicists and biologists. But more for timetabling. Whereas this year, our head of department done some incredible work and managed to actually get us to be able to teach in specialisms in year 10 to trial it. And something that we've said, right, with our current year 11s, we haven't really introduced the FIFA method. So, you know, we're just going to leave it to the teacher's discretion who's currently teaching them. But the year 10s, let's start with this FIFA method and go in strong. And it's something that's worked genuinely wonders. Whenever we do an assessment point, we as teachers ourselves, for workload, I don't know whether this is common across all schools, but we don't mark our own classes. So we mark the equivalent numbers, but all of the same papers. So for instance, I've got 3 year 10 classes, but I don't mark my year 10 classes data, but I'd mark the equivalent to 3 physics papers. And when we do that, we all then write almost like a mini examiner's report, just so, because we're not marking them individually ourselves, we're marking, one person's marking them, you know, to help with standardization. But then we sort of lose that, you know, that really important sort of aspect, which I think of actually knowing what did the kids do well and what did the kids not do well on. And doing FIFA, and not necessarily the FIFA itself, but it's that writing down the equation, inserting the numbers and showing you're working out, came up really high. And a lot of students actually got marks from errors carried forward because they were doing this technique where they weren't doing it before. a lot of students also, even if they didn't complete the question, they still got one or two marks. And I think that's really important because traditionally, when I first started teaching, you know, I used to end up marking Year 11 papers and there was loads of blank questions. No, they weren't attempting all the questions, where we've now got cohorts that answer every question, you know, and they are doing really well and they're getting the marks for it. So I think the introduction of FIFA has been really useful. In terms of what I think students really struggle with maths-wise, I think the introduction of calculating means and them having anomalies in there, students really struggle with. I hammer this whole thing, but they tend to put anomalies in the questions now, so look out for anomalies. I then have kids almost second guessing. There's always got to be an anomaly, and they just look for the data point that's the furthest out, even if it's, you know, furthest out from another one by like one. And I know that's quite, you know, a standard one. Also standard form students, I don't know how you find this, but students really struggle with standard form and significant figures. So if they've got a 4-mark question, you know, they get the 3 marks, fantastic. But, you know, that last mark, give your answer to 3 significant figures or give your answer in standard form, they don't do as well on. I don't know how you find it.
Yeah, no, you said so many different things there and I kind of got so much to talk about now.
I do have a problem shutting up.
No, it's okay. It's just perfect. Just to respond directly to the last thing that you asked, standard form. Yeah, students really struggle with standard form. And even if it's a question where they have to input it into the equation, I tell them, look, just treat this like a normal number and pull it at the top of your fraction. And they still struggle with it. And yes, that's definitely something that I think is very common for science classrooms. The idea of anomalies as well, you hit that nail on the head so well, because they either don't like notice the anomaly or they're like trying to force an anomaly. I'm gonna make that term up. It's gonna be called forced anomalies. They're kind of forcing anomalies where there's no anomalies. But yeah, just wanted to quickly take a step back to the FIFA method, because I personally use the discus method, and I find that when students use the method, they do get the carry through marks. And because obviously the example, what do they want? They want to see the students substituting in the values. That's your first mark. Your second mark's for rearranging in a calculation problem. And your third mark will be for getting the right answer. So even if you substitute in the wrong values, or even if you maybe rearranged it wrong, you've still got that first mark. So it definitely is, I've not seen the FIFA method before, but it seems much shorter than the discus method. Maybe I might have a look at that myself. But most certainly when students have, for calculation problems, when they have a method to follow, they have a higher success rate because they're actually hitting what the examiner wants to see. I definitely think you hit the nail on the head there as well. In terms of significant figures, it's funny that you say that, because my year 11s have just sat their final interim before their mock. Before their actual exams, they sat their final kind of preliminary exams that we call them, there's one question where they had to give the answer. They used a 2023 paper and they had to give the answer to standard form, and they got every single part right, and it was a really tricky problem. I think it was a SUVAT problem. It was a really, really tricky problem, and they just rounded up to they rounded down. It was 11.5 and they rounded it down to 11, and it's such a shame, quite a few of them, because they lost that last mark, and it's an easy mark that they could have got. But yeah, I wanted to quickly push on to the idea of teaching specialisms, because when I hear that, I think, wow, that's so fantastic, because I'm fortunate, I've just moved to a new school and I'm getting to teach a lot of physics, and I'm really enjoying it, like, because obviously physics is what I'm passionate about, that's what my degree was in. But I do think there's pros and cons here, and I want to see what you think about it, because I found that Yeah, teaching subject specialism is really good because you can teach the students to depth that they need to be taught in, and you really know the subject really well. And for me as a teacher, it's a win because I'm passionate about the subject. But I do actually find sometimes, and I wanted to see what you thought about this, sometimes I find that there's like little tricks or something that a teacher that's not a subject specialist, they kind of might notice something that you might not, or taking it from an angle that you might have never thought of it from. Because I think as a subject specialism, you're so kind of, you're so masterful at the content that you know, that you never think about the kind of easier ways of, or easy comparisons that you can make, or analogies that you might be able to draw. And I personally find that, and I think you might have the chance to lose that. And what's your opinion on that?
So I think this one is like a massive like can of worms, is it? There's no right answer of teaching it, should we teach in specialisms or not? I think it's almost like going down the rabbit hole of should we set classes or not for science or for any subject. And my personal opinion, I don't like teaching in specialisms. And there's a number of reasons for that. I feel, and I'm really open about this, my weakest area as a teacher is my subject knowledge. You know, teaching and learning, curriculum. I've got such like a natural sort of, you know, interest and love of that. And, you know, I'm a really inquisitive person. I love learning more about it, like how assessment happens, what we do with the data after assessment, behaviour. All of that, you know, my cup of tea. The subject knowledge itself doesn't come natural to me. And I know, you know, every teacher would have their own weak spot when it comes to their own, you know, professional development. And like I say, hands down for me, it's my subject knowledge. And I actually think, when I reflect back, one of the things that made me not want to teach at my current school, I was picking between two schools, was actually the school that I was originally going to go to. You taught in specialisms, and you even was fortunate enough to teach in specialisms at Key Stage 3. And for numerous reasons, I never ended up at that school. I ended up at my current school. And actually, I'm so grateful that I did, especially for the fact that I've got to teach all three, because the improvement that has made teaching GCSE physics and GCSE chemistry, you know, that has upskilled me massively. And it's also meant that my Key Stage 3 teaching is also a lot better. So, there, you know, if I didn't have to teach it at GCSE, it would be so hard for me to make the connections at Key Stage 3 of what's important, why they need to know this, where is it going, you know, what is the fundamental skills that they need to. And also, I think it's really important to make those links between the different subjects themselves. So I had a student, you know, I remember him asking me something the other day, and it was something to do with like the positive and negative terminal of a battery, and then we ended up talking about extracting metals and electrolysis, and I teach him physics. He was like, "But isn't this?" He's like, "This isn't physics. This is chemistry when you talk about ions." And we're going on to P3 at the minute, the particle model. And he's like, "Hold on, that's chemistry." And I'm like, but it all interlinks. Like, and I think it's a real privilege to be able to teach all of those different subjects. But with that in mind, I am not naive in the fact that, like I say, I'm really fortunate that I get to teach foundation groups. I feel such, you know, a sense of achievement being able to get those 5 5s out of these kids, that the subject knowledge that I have at the minute probably isn't as high as those who need it to get the grade 9s. So, and the hinterland that comes with being able to teach your specialist subject, and again, knowing where that, one of the reasons why I like it teaching it at GCSE so I can help the Key Stage 3 students. You could argue that at GCSE that, you know, I don't know where this is going for them at A level for the chemistry and the physics, whereas an A level and a physics specialist would. So actually being taught in specialisms at GCSE is really beneficial. And again, it's that subject knowledge. If we, when we want to get these grade nines out of the students, you know, we need to make sure that our subject knowledge is spot on and that students can do and are confident with asking the teacher. So that's sort of my take on it. Like I say, I personally don't like it, but I understand the privilege of the position that I'm in and why I don't like it and why some people would want to teach in specialisms. Again, I spoke a bit too long.
No, that's fine, that's fine. I was, when you first said, oh, I don't fully agree with the idea of just teaching specialisms, I was thinking in my head, yeah, actually, I was thinking the same thing. Because actually, I think that just like you, where you feel like it upskilled you for physics and chem, I feel like I've really been upskilled in bio and chem. And if I hadn't taught, like if I just stuck to my specialism, I wouldn't have gained the skills. And it is important and it is really good that you can learn to break things down for all of the subjects. I actually found, I did in my previous school, I taught a lot of foundation classes. And I agree with you. There's something really rewarding about teaching foundation classes, because when they start to get it, like I've always found that when I've had foundation classes, I don't know if it's a situation of maybe their prior teachers or they just feel like they don't get science. And just by drilling and getting memory and like active memory recall starters, and you're getting them to constantly remember things that they did before. But by the end of the year, they really begin to love science. And it's like a really, really nice journey to see. And I've found that like 2-3 times when I've taught at the same kind of year group, year 9 foundation classes, I've really found that they, by the end of the year, they really, really enjoy science. And you don't necessarily get that same win with, let's say, higher classes or triple science classes, because they tend to always just kind of get by with science. That's my general kind of like observations from that kind of thing. But on the idea of GCSE, I do certainly agree with you. There are just certain things that subject specialists can do and say that can set students up for A levels. And I remember when a student left my school and he went on to, because my prior school, they didn't have A levels. So he left the school and he moved on to A levels, and he sent me an email to my school account and he said, sir, you know, it's crazy because the way you taught this kind of set me up and now I really understand, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it is definitely the case that as a subject specialist, when it comes to GCSE, when you're coming to push those students, it is important that we set them up for A level, because if they choose to go down the option, they need to have the right setup for them. And by the little tricks that maybe a non-subject specialist will teach them, they don't really understand it to the depth that they need to understand it. I wanted to ask you, though, we've spoken a lot about, you know, breaking down exam questions and breaking down the techniques and so it's accessible for the students, it's a unified approach. What are your top tips for teachers looking to implement these strategies that we've spoken about in their classrooms?
I think if you were starting out in terms of doing it holistically and you're doing it from every year group, it would be, you know, start with the basic, start with the describe and the explain and the compare, those low demand questions. And like I say, work it up. Make sure that you are asking them about what that command word means. And if you see that command word, what is the strategy? And it really is a two-way approach. What the command word means, what the strategy to go with that is. And like I say, we need to make sure that we are asking these daily and that they can recall it. So I include in the activate that we are bugging the lesson outcome. So just as a quick reminder, that's we're boxing the command word, underlining the key information in that question and glancing back over the question. So if it's a bug question, if it's 3 marks or more, we teach them to bug the exam question in GCSE science. So the first thing they do when they come to the exam question, they look at how many marks it is. If it's 3 or more marks, they bug it. And again, we're making sure that they bug the lesson outcome every lesson, so they're really engaged in A, in what they're doing that lesson, but also practicing and making sure that we come across that command word all of the time. And it's actually making sure it's relevant. So if my lesson is on looking at, you know, the different stages of mitosis, I'm not going to ask them a plan a practical command word question at the start. It's making sure that it all links and we've got those hinge questions. And when we go through the guided practice of the I do, we do, you do. And I think it's been really, you know, particular with this. So it's just as if you're going to teach them, you know, some new subject knowledge. You teach them the skill in the exact same way. You model it to them. You know, you have that choral repetition. You have that retrieval practice when you're asking the questions. And I don't know about you, and I feel like we're going to go off on a tangent if we start talking about this, but I'm a massive fan of mini whiteboards opposed to cold calling. I definitely think cold calling has its space and its time in the classroom. But whenever I could possibly is use the mini whiteboards. And, you know, why ask one student what explain means and what the strategy is if you could be getting all the students to? And when you're doing your walking, talking mocks and you're going through exam papers with students, especially in year 11 at the minute, it's making sure you are teaching them those command words and what they mean. If I hadn't come across this sort of strategy before, and you know what, there's 4 weeks left, 4 school weeks left before the exams, I wouldn't want to overload students with all the different command words for science. I'll definitely, you know, download the sheet and make them aware from the blog. But what I would do is I would look at their tier, whether the higher tier or foundation tier. And, you know, if they're a higher tier, I would focus on those higher demand questions, such as your plan, your investigation, your justify, your evaluate. And if they're foundation, it would be the describe, explain and compare questions.
One second, I'm just going to play the news for this week.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and this is Teachers Talk Radio News.
The BBC News channel and news website features an interview with a secondary head teacher 1 year on from an incident in his school which resulted in a lockdown. Head teacher Kieran Stapleton confronted a male who had entered the school building, telling office staff he had a gun. The man has since been detained indefinitely in a secure psychiatric hospital. Mr. Stapleton talks of confronting the man on the corridors while staff followed lockdown procedures, locking classrooms, pulling down blinds and asking pupils to hide under desks and remain calm and silent. Mr. Stapleton used the interview to highlight the issue of mental health and the importance of support for young people in order to avoid instances of violence. He also pointed to the bravery of staff and pupils and the way they responded to the lockdown that was not a drill. The business section of the BBC News site focuses on the impact the post office scandal has had on the children of sub-postmasters. A group set up to support those affected was organised by Katie Downey, whose father was made bankrupt trying to repay money after the Horizon system failed. Ms. Downey was 11 when the family moved to France, and she stopped talking for 2 years. She set up the group Lost Chances for the Children of Sub-Postmasters as a way to support those affected, but is also trying to gain compensation for the changed lives. The group has 40 members so far, and many talk of difficult home lives, bullying at school, and feelings of shame after parents were accused. Some also shared experiences of poor mental health, eating disorders, and panic attacks. The group wants members of the public and other groups and agencies to understand how such trauma can affect children and young people. This is so that they are no longer considered as too remote from the harms caused, simply because the harm was not directly inflicted upon them. The holy month of Ramadan began earlier this month, and many schools have made arrangements to support pupils and staff who are fasting. This is something that many schools have done for years, but this year staff shortages have meant that some schools have had to modify their usual procedures. Schools report difficulties in supervising pupils who are fasting in spaces away from food and drink, as they struggle to find additional staff or enough cover for absent staff. One primary school in the east of England resorted to asking parents to take fasting pupils home for the lunch period due to significant staff shortages. Parents expressed frustration at the request, with some quoted by East England News as saying it was insensitive and ridiculous. Some did point out that the school has often been supportive in the past and that it is proud of its multicultural awareness. The school said it was working hard to find a solution to the issue, but could not compromise pupil safeguarding. Difficulties in recruitment, retention and accessing supply staff are an ongoing challenge for many schools. The University of Cambridge is scrapping its state school targets for undergraduate admissions, according to the Telegraph newspaper. The university said it would take candidate schools into account when selecting students, but would no longer have a target for the share of state and private schools' pupils gaining places. Cambridge has been accused of discriminating against pupils from private schools amid a decline in offer rates at top independent schools. Vice Chancellor Deborah Prentice said there is no discrimination, but competition is fiercer as state school pupils have been increasingly encouraged to apply. The targets were originally introduced to increase the portion of state-educated undergraduates from 63.4% to 69.1% by 2024-25. The university has beaten its target, with 72.9% of new students in 2022-23 coming from state schools. Finally, a headteacher's letter to parents on the subject of poor quality school meals has gone viral. The letter was sent after issues with the school's catering provider, Chartwell's, led to complaints from pupils over quality and portion sizes. In the letter, the headteacher says he would be exceptionally unhappy if his own children were served the food, and asks, how difficult is it to bake a potato? Whilst the letter focuses on issues with food service, it has highlighted the problems schools face around private finance initiative contract management, funding issues and the impact inflation has had on the food prices, which have left some companies struggling. Some commentators have also raised the issue of the impact poor quality meals can have on pupils who receive free school meals. It's not the first time Chartwell's has been in the news, as the issue of food quality was raised during the pandemic, when the company was accused of providing poor quality food parcels to families during school closures. Chartwell said it was working with the school to rectify issues and acknowledged that the service had fallen well below the high standards we demand. This has been your Teachers Talk Radio News with Joe Fox.
This show is brought to you in partnership with John Catt Educational, publishing professional development books and resources to support great teaching and learning in schools around the world. Have you checked out their latest releases? Use the code JCTTR2324 for 20% off your order. Don't miss out. Visit johncattbookshop.com to explore their full range of titles and advance your own professional development today. Happy reading.
And we're back. I wanted to ask you a quick question. You've mentioned in the Activate. What does that mean?
Yeah, so Activate is just our word for a do now activity, so a starter. It's just what we use at our school. And I think we're all quite unique with that. I don't know. Do you call it a DNA at your school?
We actually just call it a starter, which is quite weird because we follow all the same things. Like we use modelling, we do I do, we do you do. We have different phases of our lesson, but we literally just call it phase one of the starter. We don't call it even a do now, but it is a do now essentially.
But like, that's literally what you should, like, I feel like it sometimes we overcomplicate it. But I remember like first seeing like DNAs on like Twitter, and I was like, but that that's a geography teacher. Why are they doing about DNAs? And obviously, it's just the Do Now activities in it. And it took me a bit too long to work that out, I think. But yeah, so an activate, it's just, you know, they come in, they activate their minds to get started. But we just do it. It's six questions. And they are quick recall questions. And the key point that I really harbour, especially as a lead practitioner for the department, something that we're really focusing on is to make sure that they are, you know, one or two word answers. And we do have maths questions in there. And I think just because we touched on maths earlier, something that I've definitely started to do, especially for my 10s and my 11s, is I math skills that they struggle with, they have as part of their activate. So balancing equations and calculating relative mass was on there. And they can do that now. That is, you know, because it's routine and they've been doing them once a day since September, they, you know, it's almost like they don't even need to be on there anymore. Something that I've started to introduce, and I've seen a massive increase since, is asking them standard form questions. And it's just like, write this number in standard form, or write this number, like transfers this number from standard form, you know, out. And I think that's really grown their confidence as well.
Yeah, we personally, I do the same thing. So I have four or five starter questions, but they're like short answer questions. And I think we're gonna have to go on the slight tangent here, because I also really like mini whiteboards and I'm a really big advocate for it. And starters activity is actually a good time to test, like, to see how well your students are doing. And to be honest, any time's a good time to use mini whiteboards in the lesson. I do use cold calling as well, a little bit of cold calling, and then a straight mini whiteboard. And a whiteboard, because it's whole class engagement, whole class responses, is such a good, effective way to make sure that the class is following, they can understand what you're telling them. And definitely, I would recommend it to anyone, really. Good whiteboard routines, but also it's not just about having good whiteboard routines. It's actually about making sure you use the information you gather correctly. And I think if you're trying to push kind of to the higher level of using them in your whiteboards, I'll say that's where a lot of people go wrong. So some people have really, really good routines of mini whiteboards, but they don't use that data, they don't use that information effectively. It's just like they're kind of doing it just for the sake of doing it. And then I think those are the teachers that might not be big advocates of it because of that reason. I don't know if you've found or seen the same thing.
Yeah, so I'm really fortunate. Again, I've got a trainee at the moment, and we were talking about, you know, his lesson the other day, and we were reflecting on that, and, you know, we noticed that actually, you know, all the kids had a mini whiteboard, they had the pens, obviously the routine was embedded that when they come in the lesson, they pick up the mini whiteboard, they pick up the pen, he was asking questions, but he noticed that only about 50% of the students were actually given an answer back. And we spoke about this at the end of the lesson, and we spoke about, well, what is that issue with only 50% of the students answering? Is it that, because that's 50% of students not answering the question, is that because they don't know the answer? And in that case, we as teachers, we need to know that they don't know that, because that's the whole point. We've introduced the mini whiteboards. We want to know whether they're ready to move on with their learning or not. Or is it that they're just not listening to you and they don't know that you've asked a question? Which again, we need to know, us as teachers, we need to ensure that they are engaging in our lesson, or, you know, putting behaviour consequences in place for that. Or is it, you know, that it's not that they're not engaging, or that they're not listening, but they're just, they don't know the work, or they're not engaging with the work. It's actually just that they can't be bothered. And again, we need to know which each of those steps are. And it's about getting that right first and getting the foundations right before we can move on to that next level stuff, which you're talking about. Because ultimately, if only those 50 students are answering, 50% of students are answering, and they've got them all right, that might be like, oh, perfect, right, they've all got that right, now we can move on to the next bit, or we can go that level harder. But actually, if then the whole class was answering it, but the 50% that wasn't originally answering it, the reason they weren't answering it is because they didn't know the answer. You know, if you didn't get that information, you might have moved on and you've left that 50% behind. And I think mini whiteboards are great for whether we know, have we, you know, addressed any misconceptions? Do students truly understand this now? And it's great for using the FIFA method as well. I tell you now, the Year 10s did not like this when I first introduced it. But when they do FIFA, and especially when we first started FIFA, they had to do the whole of FIFA on their mini whiteboards, and they had to do it a step at a time. So I knew they knew what to do. So they had to write the formula out, and they just had, you know, a minute to write the formula out. And then it was 3, 2, 1, show me what they've got the formula. The next time it was insert the numbers from the question. And so on and so on. And I think I've been teaching for 6 years, and I think the last 2 years is when I can hand on heart say that my own teaching has developed the most. And I genuinely think using mini whiteboards and using them effectively was the main contributor to that. Because like you say, what is the point in using them if, you know, you saying 3, 2, 1, show me, you've planned 3 questions, they've got, as a class, 60% have got all 3 wrong, but you're just going to move on to the next bit of your lesson anyway. It's about adapting to what those answers are on those mini whiteboards. Because equally, you know, you could have 90% of them get it right and you're moving on to that next bit, that independent practice, but you know which of those students didn't get it right, and now you can go and help them while all the other students are doing the independent. Because it might just be, you know, that, you know, they weren't concentrating at that particular point and they missed something, they might misheard the question. You don't know what's got it wrong, but you haven't got time to decipher that for half of the class. But if you know it's only a couple, you can go up and ask them. So yeah, I'm a massive fan of mini whiteboards. I think the issue comes in where people are reluctant to use them is the admin that comes around them. It's been a lot of training the students, because we introduced booklets at the beginning of this academic year. So students know now when they come in straight away, they get a mini whiteboard pen, and they get the booklet sheet. And they've always, I know I keep saying how fortunate I am, like I'm never going to leave my current school, but I teach predominantly in one classroom. So the students know the setup of that classroom, where the booklets are going to be, where the mini whiteboards and where the pens are going to be as well. And it's about embedding those routines. Staff that have to move around a lot, especially in terms of mini whiteboard pens and then running out, I can understand the potential barriers that come across that. I think the best solution that I could think of is to ensure that students themselves have a mini whiteboard and a mini whiteboard pen. But again, I suppose it depends on your own school and their current context to whether you think students would all bring a mini whiteboard and a pen. If you gave them one in September, would they still have it, you know, in March, the same year? I don't know.
Yeah. To be honest, I've kind of been on both sides of the coin here, because last year in my previous school, I had my own classroom, and the mini whiteboard routine that I had was so easy to manage. I mean, the kids came in straight away as they walked in, they'll grab one whiteboard, one pen and one wiper. And when they packed up, they packed it up in exactly the way I wanted it packed up. Now, the reason for this, and I would recommend if someone's doing mini whiteboard routine, first thing, Tom Bennett, get the routine right. The next thing, and I'm mentioning him because obviously he a lot of what he talks about is about habits and routines. But the next thing is, when I find that if I'm very fussy, when I first embed whiteboards, if I'm just fussy about the way I want it laid out when they pack it back up, what this means to me is I can instantly see if all the equipment is there. Because if I have it laid out in a very particular way where I can count the equipment just by looking at it, then straight away I know that I have my equipment there, but also the students know exactly how to pack it up every single time without a fail. The next thing I found, though, now I've moved to a school where I don't have my own classrooms, probably because I've moved halfway through the year, and it has been a lot more difficult. But one strategy I found is if I have my own set of whiteboards, pens and rubbers, and my table's laid out in rows, so I have three different rows. So I have three different sets of whiteboards, pens and rubbers, and the students will pass them down the rows. And I found that to be quite effective. I know some science classes have like big lab tables as well. But if you just have enough for those different tables to distribute their whiteboards, pens and rubbers, and you have different sets for those different tables, I find that that's quite an effective strategy, because every table then has to distribute it themselves and bring it back in themselves. Because as you said, the most difficult thing about whiteboards is the admin. If I'm number one changing classrooms all the time, then, I mean, obviously carrying it around isn't the best thing to do. But if I'm changing classrooms all the time, I'm going to potentially walk into a classroom where other teachers just haven't got the right routines. They're going to be missing pens. They're going to be missing rubbers. They're going to be missing whiteboards. So I'm not going to be able to do it effectively. Distributing the whiteboards is going to be another issue. If all the whiteboards and pens and rubbers are all in the same box, then distributing them is going to be so difficult. And I don't have the time before a lesson to try and distribute the whiteboards and try and put them all back in after the lesson. So I definitely have to build up that routine. And I do find that three different boxes for my classroom layout is the best strategy to use. I don't know if you have similar tips, but the one thing I wanted to say, I feel like I've kind of gone on a tangent now as well. The one thing I wanted to say also was with the fever method, obviously, as I said, I used the discus method. And one technique or strategy that I used was I sometimes give them the question, I'll give them the answer, and I'll say, yeah, now I want you to show me the answer, show me you working out the answer using the discus method. And that's another like powerful way that it ensures that the student does the whole discus method, I found anyway. I don't know, first thing, what your kind of, if you have any like strategies for mini whiteboards, in terms of embedding it like with good routines, and also, you have mentioned the Fever one, actually, your strategy that you use for Fever. But yeah, what strategies do you use to kind of ease the administration tasks to do with whiteboards?
Yeah, so this one isn't popular with the students, although I only realised this the other week. So one thing that I do to remove the admin is I don't actually give, and I wonder if this is going to be really controversial and I'm going to get like cancelled on like Twitter for this, but I don't give mini whiteboard rubbers out. It's just, I feel like it's an extra faff. Half the kids don't use it. They just use their hands anyway. You know, they use their sleeves. I say that, I don't think they use their sleeves. I think they just predominantly use their hands. Some students, they do, again, science teachers, they go in, they get some blue roll. But, you know, I'm thinking like one student out of, you know, every year group that I teach that I can think that does that. So that definitely removes it. And like I say, it's the fact that they know that we use them every lesson, and we do use them every lesson. We've just had British Science Week, which was amazing. We obviously, the focus was time. We had loads of fun. They've made timelines. They made paper roller coasters to keep the marble going for the longest amount of time. They used water and sand and a marble and a ramp to like all different ways to measure time. But even with those, they use the mini whiteboards in those lessons. So we had that clear act debate start at the beginning. We had questions like, what, this is what we're going to do. How are we going to do it? What are the variables? Using those mini whiteboards. And it's about truly making them part of our routine, and using them all the time. And I think it's about being consistent. One of my biggest bugbears is when they're like, oh, the mini whiteboard pens run out. Okay, that happens, you know, and they'll come back to the front and they'll put the mini whiteboard pen that has run out back into the tub and collect a new one. And I'm like, no, don't put that back in there, because all you're going to do is someone's going to come to that and it won't be working, you know, next lesson. I was like, so you throw it away. And again, it's something that I've had to hammer in September, October, November, December. And it's, you know, only really February, March that, you know, I've started to notice actually they are putting them in the bin before they come and get their pen. So I think for me, that would be the key parts of routines. There are some students that I know have got their own mini whiteboards, pens now. So they've actually asked their parents to get some. And, you know, they've started to come up with all the different fancy colours. So there's one girl who's got like a purple one. And I know that there's one boy who's got like a chiseled tip one rather than the bullet point. And I think, again, it's because they know they're going to use them every time. So when they go in and, they, you know, they're looking at the stationery in the shop, they're like, oh, can we have a mini whiteboard pen so I can have my own as well? And I think that, and I wouldn't for 1 minute suggest that we have to ask all students to supply their own mini whiteboard pens. But I think it shows just how much we are using them, that they feel like, actually, do you know what? I do want my own. And again, as much as possible, do it across school. But obviously, I'm very conscious that some people, and rightly so, they don't like it when something is made whole school for the sake of it. I don't think making mini whiteboard use is for the sake of it. I think it's really informative. But if, depending on your current school and the culture that surrounds it, you know, rolling out mini whiteboard use every lesson might not be the biggest priority at the moment.
This show is brought to you in partnership with John Catt Educational, publishing professional development books and resources to support great teaching and learning in schools around the world. Have you checked out their latest releases? Use the code JCTTR2324 for 20% off your order. Don't miss out. Visit johncattbookshop.com to explore their full range of titles and advance your own professional development today. Happy reading.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I do think you're going to be cancelled on Twitter because you don't give out whiteboard rubbers. Actually, I'll tell you a little secret. My whiteboard rubbers, I feel like a lot of them just don't work. They've gone kind of flat now, but they're just, when the students put them back into the, to like my trays, they allow for the pens to kind of be laid out in a perfect way for me to count them. So that's the main reason why I had them out. I do find the same thing. I think students do tend to just use their hands or just wipe it with their sleeves or something, or just use a bit of tissue. So I don't really need to hand out as well. I do agree with you there. And I have found that students do buy their own whiteboard pens as well, which is really nice to see. I wanted to kind of, obviously, to have mini whiteboards, you need good routines, but you need good behavior management as well. And just to kind of close up, I think it would be good to kind of have a little chat about behavior management strategies and how do effective behavior management strategies contribute to creating an environment where students can learn, and we're getting close to exams now, and how it can create an environment that can be conductive to exam preparation.
Yeah, definitely. I think in terms of behavior, I think it's really subjective, obviously, to your school and your school's focus. But again, I work in incredible school where they don't tolerate disruption to learning. So we have a really clear policy where the first time something a student does that is deemed to purposely try and disrupt the learning of others, they get a warning, and the second time they get removed from the lesson. And I think that's the fact that's really, you know, powerful, actually, you know, the fact that they have got such a strict stance on that. But it's also about following the behaviour policy. And I think a lot of teachers, especially new into the profession and potentially younger teachers, and not all younger teachers and not only younger teachers, but it tends to be, they don't follow the behaviour policy maybe as strict as other teachers in the sort of bid to become students' friends, and, you know, they don't want the student to dislike them because they're doing really well in their lesson, and, you know, they want them to want to come to their lesson. And I think actually you're not doing any favours for the next person that has to go and teach that person. So, you know, if, you know, pupil A has being allowed to talk to their friend, you know, periods 1, 2, and 3, and they come to period 4, and, you know, they're getting, you know, their names written on boards, and they're being, you know, asked to stop talking, you know, it makes it so much difficult when they've been allowed to do that previously. And I think, again, in terms of good behaviour management, especially for your SEND students, as well as like students who struggle with cognitive overload, it's about the routines and being consistent. You know, if they know that at the start of every lesson, they've got 6 questions that they have to answer in silence, and that's how the start of every lesson goes, that's really helping them to know what they should and what they shouldn't be doing. If they know that when we have the guided practice stage, there's an I do bit, which the teacher models through. So we are there when we are actively watching and we are listening to what they say. And then in the we do bit, we can contribute to that. But the you do bit, they have to do independently. And again, that's routine. We do this all of the time. I think that really helps with behaviour management.
Yeah, I agree.
So that's it. I think I was just pausing.
Sorry. I was gonna say that I actually agree with you with the following the policy. I think it's so important, and sometimes I do get a little bit frustrated. Like, I remember when I was I was a PGCE, there was a ECC teacher back then, it was called NQT, it was the 1-year program, and his classrooms, the students were always messing around. They was always really loud. But if you took a class from him, I took a class from him, and it was just so difficult to kind of build rapport with the students, because for them, like, anything short of letting them do what they wanted to do just wasn't good teaching, and they wouldn't enjoy the lesson, although actually it was actually the other way around. But I do find that, yeah, I think it is an issue with younger teachers. I think it might be because, number one, like, I volunteered in schools for a really long time before I became a teacher. So I feel like the kind of idea where you're going to be the students' friends, like, it was drilled out of me. I also worked on programs with young people for a while, so I think that was just drilled out of me. But I do think that there is that issue where, obviously, new teachers, they are young themselves, and sometimes they lack the emotional intelligence needed to kind of realize that, okay, you know, I have to stay strong to what I need to do here. I need to have that tough love kind of attitude where I am going to follow the rules, because if I don't follow the rules, then, you know, these students not going to understand the boundaries, and they might try and overstep the boundaries, number one. And number two, it's not fair on everyone else in that classroom that this student is now intervening in their education and getting in the way and disrupting it. I also find that younger teachers do find it a little bit difficult there. Maybe it's because of the emotional intelligence, or maybe they just don't want to be disliked by the students, because that isn't something that they're used to in normal life. You know, we go through school ourselves wanting to be liked majority of the time. So becoming an adult and being in the same environment and finding that actually, if I am like a little bit strict with the rules, then students might not like me. Some teachers might find hard. But actually, you'll find, I think, a lot of the time that if you just stick from the beginning, you're consistent, you're fair, even if you do have a strict kind of tough love approach, not super strict, obviously, but tough love approach where, you know, well, you have disruptive learning. We use reminder, warning, and then they're out. So we call it BIR. But you've got a reminder for that. That's not what you need to be doing the work. You shouldn't be doing that. You know, warning and then BIR. And if you follow it through, eventually they're just going to accept that that's just how it is. And if it's consistent across the whole school, then eventually they're going to accept that, you know, this is how it is across the whole school. So I do agree with you completely there. That, and it is really important. Do you find, though, how do you find your year 11s now? Because I've moved to a school that I would say has more challenging behaviour. And I am finding that after doing the preliminary exams, they are becoming a bit restless. And this isn't just in my class, but it's across the board. So I was wondering if you saw something similar maybe in your school, or maybe because you've had your class since September, that might not be an issue. How are you finding that?
So I had my year 10, my current year 11 class, I had since year 10. So I built up loads of routines embedded everything that I sort of wanted out of a class into them. And we had set changes following our first lot of PPEs in year 11. And the class changed quite significantly, actually. And I remember the first 1 or 2 weeks, like, all the students were silent. And I hate a silent classroom. When it's you know, completely silent the whole time. And, you know, I do a lot of think, pair, share. I give them a lot of opportunity to talk to each other. And it was something that I was like, oh, like, really hated to begin with. And then, you know, they've been with me for quite a while now, and they are not quiet anymore. They have well and truly acclimatized to being in my class. And I think sometimes it's that change that can really affect them. So it's that if you are, like, new to a school, or even you're new to these students. So a lot of these students, although I've been at my current school 6 years, I've never taught before. So they've heard of their friends, or, you know, Miss Crofts is strict, she's this, she's that, but they've never sort of experienced it themselves. So I feel like I almost had a bit of a honeymoon period with them, although it didn't feel like a honeymoon period for me at the time, like I say, because I hate a completely silent classroom, but we got through so much work. But already they are embedded in those routines. I think at the minute now, a lot of the year 11s are nervous. You know, they have sat their second lot of PPEs. They're starting to get the results from that. You know, it's just over 4 weeks of school time left. And, you know, they are getting pulled in all directions. Like, maths want them to come to their intervention, English, photography, hospitality, sport, you name it. Everyone's asking them to go. And I think it's probably starting to dawn on them. And I think that is probably what we are starting to see. I wouldn't say it's any different to previous years. I always find it sort of funny how it's almost always the same behaviour, just different groups, if that makes sense. So, like, we always have the same thing that happens when they get to year 11. And I wonder whether it's because when they were in year 10, they saw the year 11s do it. So they almost feel like a need to do certain things and behave certain ways. I don't know.
Maybe. But by the way, set changes in year 11 is just something that causes me pure stress. Like, I understand why it has to happen. Obviously, like, you want to make sure that the final classes are have the same maybe ability. Maybe that's part of the reason. Obviously, if you're teaching a foundation class, then maybe some students need to do foundation that supports them more, and it's better for them to be in a class where majority of students are doing foundation. But it, for me as a teacher, I do find that it is very stressful. You know, I have to now, like, the students have to adjust to me, which could take a little bit of time. I have to adjust to them, and, you know, find their needs and what they, I have to now collect so much information about them to make sure that I could do it effectively and teach them effectively. I do find that can be quite stressful. Set changes any time of the year, to be honest, other than September, I just find is a little bit of a bumpy ride, but I certainly don't enjoy it when it's in year 11 at any point. My question to you, though, because we are on the conversation of behaviour, is what advice would you give to a new teacher dealing with, and this probably might be my last question, by the way, I'm not sure, it looks like we're coming kind of close to the time here. What advice would you give to a new teacher dealing with challenging behaviours while focusing on exam readiness?
So it would be to follow the behaviour policy with the year 11s just like you would any other year group. And I feel, and I'll hold my hands up, I myself sometimes struggle with this internally. You might not want to follow the behaviour policy, especially if it means that they will be removed from your lesson, because you're like, no, I need them in my lesson because we're going through X, Y and Z. But ultimately, if keeping that one student in your room so they can experience X, Y, and Z is going to hinder everyone else in the class because they will not stop being disruptive, then you've got, you know, a moral duty to do what's right for the majority of the class, not just that one student. And I think it is really difficult, and especially, you know, coming up to the end of it, it would be to do that. But at the same time, you know, these students are getting nervous, they are getting stressed, and it's actually about making sure we know what their triggers are in terms of, you know, is something going to get them more stressed if, you know, we're talking about how close the exams are and, you know, they need to be doing X, Y, and Z. And then at that point, they start to, you know, be disruptive. You've got to make sure that, you know, it wasn't as a direct response to what you were just saying. And, you know, if it was, you know, be humane about it, make sure that they're okay, and make sure, you know, that they know that they can't disrupt the learning. And if they're feeling a certain way, to ask to speak to you outside and, you know, deal with it that way rather than in a way that can become disruptive to the rest of the class.
Spot on. I wanted to say thank you very much for joining us today. Is there any last little things that you wanted to say to kind of close up?
No, I just wanted to thank you for having me, and hopefully people have gained some useful insight to our conversations.
Yeah, this has been a really, really great conversation. I think I need to get on Scientists more often. That was actually really, really fun to have a chat with you. We spoke about a lot of things, exam techniques, whole school, the bug method, command words, explain questions, QLAs, fever method. We spoke about quite a lot, so it has been fantastic to have you on. Thank you very much for that.
No worries. Thank you. Good night.
Good night.
You've been listening to Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live and listen back at ttradio.org. We look forward to hearing from you next time on Teachers Talk Radio.